Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. If there is one thing in common between the Russians and the Americans, it is a deep-seated belief that the passage of time reveals the moral truth. From St. Augustine to Martin Luther King, from President Obama to President Putin, and now President Biden, they all have associated themselves and their causes with the right side of history. But is the divide between good and evil indeed so stark and irreconcilable? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Charles Kupchan, Senior Fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University. Professor Kupchan, it's a very rare treat for me these days to speak to Western experts and former officials like yourself. I'm very, very grateful for this opportunity, but I also have to ask you, why did you decide to talk to RT, given the, you know, the potential academic and professional repercussions that you may face?
Well, I'm someone who believes that we should keep the corridors of communication, even as the relationship between Russia and the United States gets worse and worse, even as the war goes on and casualties continue to mount. I think that you know, dialogue is always better than no dialogue. So that's why I'm sitting here having this conversation with you.
Thank you for that. And the previous time I interviewed you was, I think, in the summer of 2017, when we thought that the relationship between Russia and the United States hit their lowest point after Crimea and all this pseudo-Russian mythology surrounding the Trump administration. This is the way it's seen from Moscow, at least. But in hindsight, it seems that back then it wasn't that bad. Do you think we have hit the rock bottom already, or the worst is yet to come?
It's hard to say. I mean, we are clearly at one of the lowest points in U.S.-Russian relations, and I would include the Cold War in that. I think this is as dangerous a moment as we've seen, because right now we're in a hot war in which bombs are dropping, missiles are flying. Fortunately, Russia is not in a war with NATO, but it's conceivable that this war could spread. You know, many of us feared, going back to 2014, that the Russian annexation of Crimea and intervention in Donbas could just be the beginning, and that at some point Russia might try to create a land bridge between Donbas and Crimea. That seems to be what's happening as we speak.
Let's talk about what you think is the reasoning for such dramatic action, because after the Crimean operation, I fully agree with you, despite all the domestic support that it had, Russia had to pay pretty substantial cost, both in terms of sanctions, you know, diplomatic pressure, lost opportunities, etc. Now, what we are having in Ukraine is of much bigger scale, human suffering, destruction, huge costs, economic costs to Russia. And yet, I think you've studied Russia for quite some time. You, I think, know that Putin is a rational leader. Why do you think he made the decision that he made?
Well, you know, I'm glad you raised this issue of Putin's rationality, because I'm someone who did see Putin as aggressive, as difficult, as expansionist, but as calculating, as rationalist. He took risks, but they tended to be relatively small risks at low cost, grabbing South Ossetia, Abkhazia, Crimea, Donbas, going into Syria, Nagorno-Karabakh, Libya, These were relatively efforts to
He didn't grab all of them. But this is a misstatement. I mean, there were Russia's involvement in all those territories, but they were different in nature. You know, South Ossetia is not part of Russia at this point of time, just as Nagorno-Karabakh, by the way. Libya is not part of Russia, neither is Syria. So, you know, let's be differentiated for the sake of your own students. I think you don't want to lump all those.
South Ossetia and Abkhazia aren't that different from Crimea and Donbass. They're both land grabs into their neighbors' countries. Yes, I agree with you. Syria and Libya are different. But the point here is that these were relatively small operations. Going into Ukraine is different. I'm someone who did not think that Putin was actually going to invade Ukraine because I thought it was such a miscalculation, such a dangerous and reckless move. And I think that Putin really was delusional. He believed what he said. He believed that behind every Ukrainian was a wannabe Russian, and that the Russian troops would go into Ukraine and the Ukrainian military would collapse and everybody would say, oh, thank God the Russians are here. That's a Ukraine that doesn't exist. Ever since 2014, including in eastern Ukraine, Ukrainians want nothing to do with Russia. I would have thought that Putin understood that. That's why his invasion has been such a miscalculation and has gone so poorly. He misunderstood Ukraine.
I think you're operating on the assumption that Russia will be trying to essentially swallow Ukraine, incorporate its territory into Russia proper. And I hear a lot of high-profile Russian analysts arguing against that. They believe that that is going to be the worst possible scenario for Russia. And neither Putin nor any of his generals ever voiced such intention on record. So again, if we try to stay in your previous framework of Putin being a rational rather than delusional actor, what could possibly be the rationality? And I'm pressing you on that because you actually laid it out in your articles. Can we for once mention NATO here?
Well, I mean, I think that Putin's aims have shifted. I would agree with your Russian colleagues. I don't expect Russia to try to swallow Ukraine now, because I think they've realized that it would be swallowing a porcupine, that it's not going to work, that there are 44 million seething Ukrainians who would marshal an insurgency against a Russian occupation. That's my assessment of why Russia has changed its war aims to trying to enlarge its land grab in eastern Ukraine, have a bigger chunk of Donbass and connect it to Crimea. I'm guessing that Russia won't continue to push to the West, but who knows? My fear here is that Putin isn't as calculating and rational as he used to be. And my evidence for that is the invasion of Ukraine itself. It was a mistaken move. As far as NATO's concerned, there's no question that the enlargement of NATO going back to the 1990s has been a major source of grievance between Russia and the West. But I do think that there was a conversation taking place late last year into early this year that gave Putin the wiggle room that he needed. Biden said, school's out. Ukrainian membership is not under consideration. The president of France talked about Finlandization. President Zelensky himself said, maybe this NATO membership thing isn't going to happen. If Putin had wanted to, he had trade space. He could have picked up on those leads, but he didn't. And that says to me that he wanted to invade. He had already made the decision to invade, and that's why he did.
Well, Professor Kupchin, on that specific point, both you and I know that there was a last-ditch diplomatic effort to settle this peacefully without the use of military force. There were a couple of phone calls between the Kremlin and the White House throughout the year. There was a meeting in Geneva between Putin and Biden, a long meeting during which they, according to my sources, discussed different ways that Russia and America exert their influences on neighboring populations, on neighboring countries and peoples. They also discussed security sensibilities. And I was told, at least, that they reached a tenuous agreement to leave and let leave. And that's why the diplomatic effort continued after that. Why do you think it didn't work out at the end?
I don't know what the Kremlin's thinking was on Ukraine, but clearly they were considering military intervention for quite some time. We saw the mobilization of forces earlier last year, then those forces pulled back. Then late last year, we start to see a very substantial deployment of forces, close to 200,000 on three sides, the south, the east, and the north, really threatening to carry out what has happened, which was a full-scale invasion of the country. Why Putin decided to do that rather than to stay at the negotiating table, I don't know. This is an issue that could have and should have been resolved through diplomacy. For some reason, you probably know better than I, Putin decided that his preferred option was to use military force. I think part of the problem here is that he realized that he was, quote unquote, losing Ukraine, that ever since 2014, after the Russian intervention, Ukraine was really beginning to chart its own course. It was no longer wanted to be part of a Russian sphere of influence. That appeared to be intolerable to Mr. Putin. He said as much in his speeches. He said, Ukraine is part of Russia. Ukraine doesn't deserve to exist as an independent state.
Professor Kopchan, you are not accurate. He never said about Ukraine not deserving to exist as a sovereign state, although he did say that there are many cultural, historical, ethnic links between our peoples, and he does indeed believe that the Russian and Ukrainian people historically are part of one collective. Now, having said that, I do think that he was afraid of losing Ukraine, but on a different ground, because starting in 2014, Ukraine was increasingly militarized by various NATO members without even assuming NATO treaty obligations. Don't you think that in and of itself presented a major strategic vulnerability for Russia? NATO using Ukraine, prostituting essentially Ukrainian territory for its own means without even taking the obligations to protect it when the push comes to shove?
Well, number one, he did say that Ukraine is part of Russia, and he did refer to these linguistic, historical, religious ties. And yes, there are such ties, but that doesn't mean that Russia has a right to invade and try to occupy its country. Those days are
Absolutely.
Long gone.
I agree with you 100%, but it also doesn't mean that Ukraine has the right of, again, prostituting its land to allow a pretty hostile military alliance to pose a major strategic threat for Russia. And you yourself are on record saying that all major powers desire strategic breathing room. How else could Russia ensure that strategic breathing room without Ukraine being either neutral or under some other agreement that would allow Russia not to be fearful about, you know, 3 minutes that it would take for rockets to be launched from Kyiv to Moscow?
Well, I object to the language that Kyiv is prostituting itself. Kyiv was making its own sovereign choices about how it wanted to conduct its foreign policy, first of all. Second of all, the military support that NATO gave to Ukraine over the last several years, going back to 2014, was actually quite limited. NATO provided, eventually under the Trump administration, a limited number of javelins, anti-tank weapons, but was otherwise giving mostly small arms, mostly training, mostly advice. It was not giving Ukraine the ability to pose a military threat to Russia. There were no missiles. There would not be any missiles that Ukraine could use to strike against Russia. But I will grant you this. I can understand why Russia would feel uncomfortable with NATO coming closer to its borders. But that's why I think this is an issue that could have and should have been resolved at the negotiating table. But let's be honest, Ukraine was not given the kinds of weaponry and is still not being given the kinds of weaponry that pose a threat to Moscow or Russian territory. That is simply a false claim.
Professor Kopchan, I really, really want to return to this claim, but after a very short break. Can we do that in a few moments?
Sure.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Charles Kupchan, Senior Fellow at the Council for Foreign Relations and Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University. Professor Kupchan, before the break, you mentioned that it was a false premise of mine to suggest that, you know, NATO was militarizing Ukraine and that it ever presented any military threat to Russia. And I want to mention two points here. Before doing this show, I was a war correspondent, and I was on the ground in Libya and Syria. And it was pretty easy to observe there that you don't need to heavily arm the entire population, the entire country to destabilize it. You know, it takes, you know, only a small minority to wreak chaos. And Russia's history itself is a good example of that. And the second point is that I'm sure you're following the Munich Security Conference. That's a top security conference in the West. And it was at that conference that President Zelensky earlier this year openly talked about acquiring, the idea of acquiring nuclear weapons. And no one in the audience or no one in Western capitals said anything to that effect, even though presumably there is still nuclear non-proliferation regime in place around the world. Don't you think that that in and of itself sends the kind of signals that, anxious Moscow could have interpreted, not the way that you would want it to interpret?
Well, again, it's kind of a preposterous idea that Ukraine is going to attack Russia. Ukraine minds its own business. Ukraine has been reforming its military, making it more capable, but showing no signs of having aggressive intent against anybody. So the idea that Russia invaded Ukraine to neutralize a threat, that's simply not credible. It's simply not credible. The bigger issue of NATO enlargement and NATO membership, I understand, but there was no imminent threat that warranted Russian military intervention. This is a problem that should have been resolved at the negotiating table. Putin owns this war.
Well, Professor Kupchan, I agree with you 100% that Putin owns this war, and not just Putin, but also Russia. We will carry this sin for years, decades, and perhaps even generations to come. This is a huge tragedy for all of us. We all have relatives in Ukraine, and they call us actually every single day. We are, you know, very much connected to that conflict, no illusions about that. But at the end of the day, Putin is the president of Russia, and he has obligations before Russia in defending its strategic security. Don't you think, again, and we keep circling around that question, that the West could have been a little bit more accommodating, if not for the sake of Russia, then for the sake of Ukraine, in providing Russia with the security that it asked for? And what it asked for is simply the guarantees of neutrality and Ukraine not joining any other military alliances. What's the goal? What's the purpose of repeating that Ukraine can join NATO one day? What's the benefit of that? Tell me.
Well, I think we're in agreement that this war is a tragedy and that there are no winners. I do think that the rub here was the tension between the principle. The West wanted to stand by its principle that NATO's doors were open, that countries in a world of sovereignty and liberal democracy should be able to make their own choices, that Russia should not have a veto over the choices of free and independent countries. But the reality was the Ukrainian membership in NATO, precisely for the reasons that we've been talking about, was not under consideration. It was not imminent. It was not on the agenda. That should have been enough to provide Mr. Putin and his colleagues the needed room to find a way out. Under those circumstances, I don't understand why Mr. Putin opted for a military invasion, which is going to be a huge cost for his country for a very long time to come.
I really want to ask you about the matter of principle, because this is a very hot issue here. And you wrote recently that Washington's commitment to keeping NATO's doors open to Ukraine, speaking about not being under consideration, was a quote, a laudable and principled stand against an autocratic Russia. And as far as I can see, then I have an extended family in Ukraine. Some of them are in bomb shelters. These people believe that Ukraine was very cynically used by America and abandoned by America in the time of need. It now has to deal on its own with a much stronger army. Can you explain me what is so laudable, what is so principled about that?
What's laudable and principled about it is, number one, that the United States has in its DNA the idea that people should be free. And it has seen NATO enlargement as a tool for standing by that principle. And I think that's one of the reasons that Mr. Biden, the Secretary General of NATO, other NATO leaders were unwilling to renounce that principle. But it's not accurate to say that Ukraine is on its own. Ukraine has enormous support. Ukraine is getting a huge amount of political, economic, and military support from NATO countries, even though a decision has been made, correct in my mind, not to escalate, not to put boots on the ground, not to enforce a no-fly zone, because that would mean war between NATO and Russia. That could mean World War III.
Now, you mentioned that NATO supposedly is being very deliberate not to, you know, make provocative gestures towards Russia. And just the other day, American secretaries of defense and state met with some of their allies at the American military base in Germany to discuss the possible supplies of weapons which are going to be used against the Russian army. Now, I know that you advised President Obama on European affairs, so I'm sure you understand the implications and sort of historic associations, connotations of anyone meeting at a military base in Germany to discuss the supply of arms to be used against the regular Russian army. Do you understand how dangerous it could be? I mean, I'm asking you as a person who was born in St. Petersburg. I mean, my own family suffered under the siege, as has Putin's family. I mean, you can laugh at that, but we all carry that in our blood.
No, I understand that. I'm smiling because it's Russia that has attacked Ukraine. Russia has started this war, and NATO and the United States are providing the Ukrainians the ability to defend themselves. And they have been quite explicit about avoiding the kinds of weapons that could lead to potential escalation. So on the contrary, the US is not abandoning Ukraine. It's helping the Ukrainians fight back, and the Ukrainians have done a remarkable job. But let's be honest, the risk of escalation is still considerable. Russia might decide to interdict weapons coming in from NATO territory. We've heard Russia threaten the potential use of nuclear weapons, which is unthinkable. And that's why I think we need to see de-escalation and a ceasefire and a diplomatic effort as soon as possible to avoid those much more dangerous outcomes.
You mentioned recently that the United States, in the light of all that danger, needs to return to realpolitik. And when I was a student in America, our professors used to insist on operationalizing abstract concepts. Can I ask you for the same favor? Can you actually explain exactly how the United States could return to realpolitik? Because as far as Moscow is concerned, American actions are totally illogical when it comes both to Russia and much of the rest of the world. You mentioned the idealistic orientation that the United States supposedly has, and you know, bending the arc of history towards justice. We see it in a completely different light, with millions of people sent to their deaths in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, and now in Ukraine, by the Americans trying to make this world a better place.
Well, you know, I think on balance, the United States has succeeded in making the world a more decent place.
Give one example for our international audience. One recent example when American efforts, especially defense-associated efforts, you know, related to NATO and spreading of democracy, when that led to lasting peace or stable peace, as you like to talk about.
Well, you know, I would go back to World War II. When the United States intervened to help defeat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. And we've seen a major expansion in the footprint of democracy and freedom of the rule of law ever since. Has the United States made mistakes? You bet. Did the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq turn out well? No, they did not. But I would say this, they were motivated by good intentions. They were motivated by the desire not just to take down extremist groups in Afghanistan, but to help Afghanistan stand up as a democratic, pluralist, liberal country, and that effort failed. I cannot attribute benign intent to Russia's use of military force. Its invasion of Ukraine is a bout of aggressive territorial conquest. Russia, unfortunately, does not have the same noble aims as the United States.
Professor Kupchin, what matters in realpolitik is not your intentions. You can ascribe to yourself whatever noble causes you want. What matters is the results. And I'm asking you again, can you mention a single conflict that the United States got itself involved in over the last, let's say, 20 years that led to a lasting peace? Because if you mentioned Second World War, we were allies back then. We had no problems with the United States, or little problems with the United States. Now we are enemies, precisely because the United States took it upon itself to change the world by military means and make it far more dangerous than it was in the beginning.
No, actually, World War II is an important one, and it shows that Russia and the United States can work together, and maybe one day we can get back to that, although I don't think it's going to occur while Mr. Putin is the president. But I do think that even in the post-Cold War era, we have seen, number one, the United States and NATO go into the Balkans and stop ethnic conflict there. There hasn't been any bloodshed in that region since the end of the dissolution of Yugoslavia. And the United States has, in many respects, helped bring down and fight extremism. Who led the counter-ISIL campaign? The United States. That's a war that worked to the benefit of Russia. Again, has the United States made mistakes? Yes. But has it succeeded in largely taking down the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda? Yes. Has it made the world safer from Islamic extremism? Yes. So it's a mixed picture. But over the course of its history, I think the United States has been on the right side. It's been on the side of democracy and freedom and justice. Unfortunately, I cannot say the same thing about Russia.
We are out of time. Let me again express my gratitude for engaging with us in this conversation. It's been great talking to you. Thank you very much for that.
It's been my pleasure. Let's keep the conversation going.
Thanks. And thank you to our viewers for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.